か。
はい。
ああ、ファーストフェリー。
アナウンス。
フレートフェリ
ー。で、ビエテルビー。
で、カルベシのビ
ー。ユニフォールドシャー。ユニフォールドビー。Islamic Revolution. One of the anniversaries. This is the 8th anniversary, military anniversary, 8th anniversary. It's been presented also in China. They have this peacefully today. Mashhad. Mashhad is the Russian border. It's called the shrine of 8th Imam. Imam Reza.One of the holy cities in the other Qum.
Did you see Qum?
No, that night it bombarded. So that Qum temple, the Iraqis bombarded the Qum. You know, they've been destroying hospitals, mosques, you know, bombarded. So for our safety, they didn't take us. There was a quick trip that afternoon, but to listen to the.
What is it?
Yeah, no meeting call.
The
security was
like our special branch.
Yeah. Special branch. Yeah. That was called
Savak. Savak was a special branch of the former regime.
Yes. I've heard about it. Highly
efficient.
Did you listen to any of their ayatollahs?
Yes. We had the fortune to listen to Ayatollah. Mr. Khomeini. Yeah, it was on one of the days. And it wasn't on the program, but previously the guy warned us that he might be going on the following morning. They took us there. He lives in Mokro, Tehran. Not of Tehran. Tehran is a city of 9 million people. And they took us there and we had to go through the North Tehran, which is supposed to be the posh area with double garages and different. That's very wealthy. Even his lived, or still lived.
Our house,
yes.
You know, that's really
funny. Yeah, so this is the thing. So when we went there, he lived in two rooms in a mosque there. The village is the village of Jambul.
Jambul. It comes from the mosque.
And there's a transformation as you go through the elite area. You suddenly come to mud houses. The walls not painted, plastered, nothing. And there's a description in the big port. You can see some of the government. And he addressed us in Farsi for 20 to 30 minutes. He was 86 years old. Amazing chap, remarkable. You know, we've been under the impression that he was another Hitler, right, or Stalinist, you know, one of those dogmatic chaps. When he sat there, you know, he took a simple chair. Covered with a pale blue cloth. He said to me, no assistance, he came in the water. It's also an idol. I said, there's something else I don't. And he addressed us in something for about 20 to 30 minutes. But it was reported in the Tehran Times about a minute. Basically, the theme was unity of Muslims, that we must fall, you know, pray to the propaganda of the West and the East. Which says that, you know, that the different sects and things are that Islam is a total religion and there should be unity.
Is your speech translated or not? was translated on the spot.
No, it wasn't translated. He's old, you see, I don't know what put into that this concept. So, usually what they do is they have two interpretations. Official one is interprets in Arabic and one is in English. We each were given a guide from the Imam Tariq University. Students who are proficient in both three languages, Farsi, Arabic, and English. My guide spoke Arabic and English.
Those two.
These are students. This is a new university which has gone up, where you do any course, Farsi, where it's compulsory to do 1 year of Islamic jurisprudence. So every course is extended by further year. It's run not by the state, but from money collected from people. It's a university in the north west of Tehran. And you know, I think the students are given off, you know, the 300 delegates.
The idea of running an institute by the money of the people is basically.
Well, this is one of the. It's run. Well, education is free there. But this has a totally Islamic emphasis.
So then, this is given the big gift to Mishra University. It's also from funds raised by.
Yeah, that's very interesting. If you go to Mishra
centers of learning.
Yeah, there's a where that guy is. They call it Haram Sharif too. They've got the university at Chess Street. Very well. I believe their libraries have got their real universities, half a million books, 2,000 that you see. They're very rich in literature, Farsi. And what we have, as you go through the towards Mashhad, they've got shops, beautiful architecture, face brick but with mosaic. And they said that all belongs to the Haram Sharif. The money the Shah used to take from them and used to spend also. Now, of course, it's not. They use it for running the university. They run free canteen there. Quite a big one. People just go and eat in the bottom. Users go and eat. They don't pay. But all the income is from the. I think it must be a street of a kilometer.
Yeah.
That which the money comes to the Shah has a palace there, which he used to use for 2 hours in a year.
2 hours a year.
When he used to come to the Dargah. it must be the size of Buckingham Palace. I mean the grounds, hectares it got.
Very good.
And it's fabulously furnished.
Now they
turned it to a museum. Yes.
Is it for people to see how
lavishly he lived?
How he lived.
We went
to the
rooms with bar tables. The one we saw was in his mother's place in North Tehran. And that's all we done. His mother had a special room with, bar tables, all kinds of bedding. And nothing Islamic except the carpet. Or not even Islamic, yet, everything is just pictures, from now. France. The only thing that was local was the carpets. The one reception here, 130 square meters, hand woven carpet, all fitted. Now the only way it's handmade is the two bars, the door, they've taken out the door to see into the room, and you can see the fringe. But they've converted into museums. Those are not used by anybody.
It's a guided tour from the government side?
Not totally guided. We went out on our own. Mashhad also, we hired a taxi. We went to the Dargah, and when we went there in the morning, we were taken to a reception room. Chandeliers and glass colors. Amazing. But there were three of these. We waited there, and then we learned that they were clearing the Haram Sharif for us to go because special guests. So I thought that was inside. So
there was a night I was being interviewed by people who are developing the whole Muslim. So
sociology. Yes, sociology. So philosophy and social work.
Get into it with my guide. I went back at 9 o'clock. I want to see what happens. You know? It's quite an amazing scene. People, most probably most tourists come there and really make them pray. And they want to be with us. But very interesting that
so you say Kaaba.
Not Kaaba, they put his grave there, you know, with the chandelier and things like that.
In fact, far less simple than anything I saw in India.
Yeah.
And you know, the only thing that that we saw happening there is that people came there
cried.
Yeah.
But at night I saw was, you know, people, young boys, 18, 20 who had been disabled, you know, in wheelchairs. Were parked. At 9 o'clock they were taken there. And it's a sight which moved me more than anything else. Young boys clinging there and asking his intercession, you know, for them to be cured, which is unlikely because these are four victims. And after they left, the young soldiers, khaki uniform, you take off your shoes of course, came in and then, you know, praying there. The day before, a few days later, they went to the front, asking for, you know, guidance, comfort. I've never seen this anywhere. You know, it's the most moving scene.
No, no, this
whether one approves of them or not, it's
so moving. You know, the point that I have got to mention is that one would expect that if you go to a truly Muslim country, the one thing must notice is that there are no bars, there are no, restaurants, you know, where you have cabarets, the food that
you see. Okay.
Cinemas, right, there are the, you know, the cinemas, the kind of obscene things that you see, out. Now, you know, I mean, look, the simple point is that, I mean, we want to learn from that. At one point, is I think we tested it, that visibly, look, the hotel that we were in, I mean, there's nothing left of the old ways, right? Like the saturation of women,
everyone's job,
going to the streets, you know, the kind of thing that you see in Muslim and non-Muslim countries, all the big cities of the world. There, the first thing that would strike you is all the things that Muslims have been saying should not be done has been visibly eliminated from the daily lives of people. Now, you know, I mean, that there can be, you can't. I mean, the guides can't tell you. I mean, we have eyes to see.
Yeah.
You understand?
In the plane, I mean, when we were there, you know, the thing was that, look here, they tell you when we took over that you are now entering the Islamic Republic of Iran, we will cover their heads. You know? That
which is a Islamic law, even out of Iran, even in South Africa, anywhere else.
Yeah, it's a simple point I'm trying to make that you see visibly those ways.
Yeah, and they have implemented it. You know, it's like, you know, the airways, like Saudi Arabia would have, you know, women in shorts. Yeah, this.
No, Saudi Arabia, maybe in Makkah, Medina.
No, in the airways. Saudi Arabian airways.
Only find words.
Saudi Arabian Airways, you know, they employ.
The point I'm making in Iran is complete.
Complete.
Anywhere you go to.
They have hostesses on the plane, you know, but they are all in hijab. No music.
Very good. Very nice.
And, you know, these are manifestations of, you know, some manifestations. Oh, walking the streets. You know, those people who opposed to the revolution say that there is compulsion on women to wear the hijab or chador. Because they say, you know, they won't get served in post offices and banks and that, so they are compelled to wear it. That might be true, I don't know, we couldn't verify that. But what's a very interesting thing is that it took a 6 young boy, so it has been, you know, have taken photographs, you know, people sitting, I mean, you know, and this
is the heart of the city.
No ties have gone, their shirts are no longer with collars. They're what they call a mentoring collar. You didn't see that. And the simplicity is there, you know, I mean, I went to see, you know, I just told him, look here, you know, when that trip was cancelled to Kumasi, look, you know, can't you let me see someone from the the Department of Health. The next thing is a young chap comes to meet me, and with me there was a health worker from Lebanon, and they took us to the Ministry of Health at 8:30. The Deputy Minister of Tabatabai was in there. The office was the most hostile I've seen. Still there's cabinets, picture of Khomeini was there, and there was some health poster. Spoke to him through the civil sector. So I interpreted for both of us, and that fellow was a heritage student. And we discussed what's Islam, what they were doing about them developing new types of drugs without alcohol, and you know, the resistance that's going on. And then, we came to the office of the hotel. So we got into the same car we got, and we said, I think it's a Toyota Datsun. So the three of us got in for the back. I said, in center, the Lebanese and my guy there. In front, the driver, who happens to be a student at university, he was a son of the deputy minister. The deputy, he sat between the bucket seat and his secretary. And this is how they brought us. Now, there's been this leveling. You know, here, Muti Avramji, who's not even a minister, runs around in a, and Ismail Mayat runs around in a Mercedes now, or his BMW 7 Series, you see. Now, this is that, you know, this is the simplicity. And this is why I think there's been this mutual arrangement between the people and the Muslim. We heard the president, you know, is called Hujjatul Islam. You know, so he has the rank Ali Khamenei. And we heard him at the Friday Khutbah and at the Independence Day celebration. I think he was also, we were 2 days late. You know, they have this cemetery there. They have a cemetery
there.
You know, the main place. So people saw it there, but we just heard it twice. We saw the Prime Minister Musawi, then we saw the speaker, and we had the opportunity to listen there. Of course, there was a person with us who wanted to see the president. Came to the hotel. For no reason, I mean, there's no reason for this. I just see that.
From what you people say, I think you people were the only people from South Africa that were allowed free access everywhere else, because other people that is wrong. They were kept in a hotel. There was a guard at the door of the hotel. They can't even go out of the hotel to go buy a packet of cigarettes. They go to tell the guard, and the guard will buy cigarettes.
We didn't realize it was 62 months, which in exchange we found out was $8, is 16 reds for 20 cigarettes. Now you see how they say you can go out to take a guide with you.
The guide had to round them up because they all let them loose, if you remember.
They got lost.
You see, they told them, look, go around and you know, meet at a particular place.
No, but you know,
at that particular time, we were not there. Mm-hmm. So who told you this, Mohammed?
No, I spoke to quite a few people that had been.
It was, they said,
when they were on this
island, they looked after you well.
Look, they were only taken to certain places. They were not allowed to go anywhere.
Oh, we went to
see. They were only allowed
to go. Our guide's brother is the host of the revolution.
Certain places only they were allowed. I think you people were among the few, only people that were allowed to go where you people wanted. From my information, the other people are not allowed. They were only taken, you know, they have a set stand to, they take them to Parliament buildings. And whatever is happening in Parliament building that time for half an hour, then
one morning I could have gone alone. You know, I mean, Mishar.
Yes.
And then I said, I'll use my way.
Yeah, the problem.
So, you know, I took Lisa with and we just moved off.
Look here, we
moved
did
moved off for what? About easily two and a half.
We did the bazaar. You see, they have guided tours like the bazaar in Tehran. You know, they took a bus. We went with our, you know, we didn't go with a bus because, you know, we went to a youth center and then we met them. But, you know, 2 hours later they couldn't find the fellows. You know what the bazaar is? A kilometer long. You know, and little alleys and gullies. And we went.
So you
came up with me to for the
yeah.
me.
Come on.
Story is high.
There was that rigid control.
You know what, Kasi? I beg to differ. I can't agree with it.
Yeah.
I've been there.
Now, why haven't you?
All right, you people were allowed there.
Why?
I've been to major countries in the world and I didn't get lost. I got back to South Africa.
No, it's not lost. At the moment, there's war.
Sao Paulo, one of those.
They had to guard right on
Sao Paulo was the nation at war.
No, but the war is not in Tehran.
Oh, no, the bomber. We saw the bomber. On the day of celebration.
With my own eyes, man.
Shooting in the. I can claim to have slept in the revolution.
And here you see, look, besides, look, we're not going to the right or wrong one. We simply talk about the support for the, you know, for the regime there. The Iraqis warn the people of Tehran that if you come out on that way, you will bombard Tehran. Right? And instead, what happened? You know this Azadi Maidan, it takes easy about 1.5 million people. But the highway leading up to it is about 15 kilometers long, a dual highway. The overflow crowd was at least 2 times the people, you know,
1 million people.
Right? And among them, men and women, literally hundreds of thousands of women. Very in a very dignified way, away from, you know, I mean, separated from them. Right. So, now what were you saying?
About not allowing
people. No, I was saying, I've been to South Korea,
wait, let me now complete the thought. Now, that day, the Iraqis did come. And they were, you know, intercepted by the Iranian. The same night when I was in the hotel room, I couldn't sleep. Right? And certainly, my way, you can ask the others there, Tom.
There was a silent room.
You know, there was a dogfight that night in the hotel. So, I mean, that now, if you bring over 200 to 300 people as foreign visitors to your country, I mean, surely the government is going to take precautions during wartime.
Yeah, but now, all right, you people were there, this happened. But we can't say for the past 5 years or 7 years, everybody that's been going out.
But how long has the war been going on?
The war has been there since 1939.
How long has the war been?
5 months after the revolution started, you know, instigated Saddam to attack.
The Iraqis and the, you know, and the other imperialist powers, do you remember there was a time when, you know, when there was always assassinations of, you know, a number of Ayatollahs and all that stuff. And there was a fight, right? You know, where they closed up the universities and all that. And things looked really bad, right? In every country with the revolution, the early period, you are going to have the counter-revolution. So they were handling that. And the Iraqis actually thought that the rule of the Ayatollahs was so shaky at that time that they would use that opportunity to stop it, right? And they made a lightning death. You see, this was like that's when they talk of the imposed war. And it was an undeclared war.
Yeah, but
it was penetrated overnight.
Why is Shia fighting Shia? Eh? Why is Shia fighting Shia?
No. Saddam is an agent of the American imperialists.
He's belongs to the Baathist Party, which is not Islamic.
These people were reconstructing. But what they realized is the notion and the concept of the Islamic revolution succeeds. The taking over entire societies and bringing them under Muslim rule. That is a dangerous idea for the imperialists. Now, for the first time in contemporary history, whether now look, we are not living in the moment here. The fact is that the Iranians have said, the Ayatollahs have said, that we recognize no boundaries and we recognize no nationalism. And this is the beginning of the revolution of Islam. Right? Now Iraq, right, the imperialists used Iraq. Now you have the strange situation where the Soviet Union also functioned endless supply of arms, the Americans also supply.
The Americans supply both people. Americans supply Iran and Iraq.
Yeah, that will explain to you how that will work.
Take a simple common sense thing. Who produces arms, right? It is the imperialist nation, and it is, you know, it is the communist nation, right? And here you have a country like Iraq, right? Massive supplies of arms, right? I mean, an endless supply. And now they're hitting Iran. Now, Iran doesn't produce missiles. It doesn't produce all those things. It doesn't produce, the arms technology. Every nation in the world, you either buy from
Russia or from
the Soviets. Now, what must the Iranians sit back and, you know, invite suicide? Now, South Africa has proved it, right? That if you have the money, you can buy any amount of arms on the international market, the black market, right? And the Iranians, when they began, that Algerian pact, right, where they were trying to get the Shah, the money that he looted, come back there. At the time of the war, there was something like $5 billion American dollars, which the Americans actually owed the Iranians. Now this kind of thing about spare parts and all that, there's the money, your money is guaranteed, give us the spare parts, and that is where, right? Now, no nation, I think, really, if the Iranians, the argument would be nonsensical, to say because you are opposed to the imperialists, you must now wait and come, invite them to slaughter you with their, with their missiles and their nuclear weapons and all that, come, kill us. I mean, there's no way, no, it doesn't make, sense to anything to human beings. So this, but the war was there. And the thing is, normally, especially in an undeveloped country, third world country, when there is war, the economy is, goes into a deep state of chaos. The cities, essential services are messed up. Now nobody, the one thing, all right, no guy cares. Now this is what I say. What we are talking about, we are not talking of finer points of theology. We are saying what the eye can see. The shops were filled with goods. The hospitals were functioning. The factories are functioning. There is traffic, right? There is order. There is trade.
Right?
People are living normal lives. There is food. You don't see long queues of people waiting for bread and all that, right? The cities are functioning cities, right, in spite of the war. Now that in itself is a remarkable achievement. That a country, usually a third world country, collapses. But what is the reason? First of all, they have not only applied themselves to the spiritual context of Islam, like the Muslim mindset, but they've applied their mind to the whole question of how to run a state, a country. Right? So the essential services are there. The civil service function. Right? Young people, right? 18, 19 years after 25 years, the Revolutionary Guard are running the whole country. And that is one of the great things, the heart of it, that you have a group of people, young people, who are literally running the country on behalf of what they believe in, the Islamic Revolution. Airports are completely under their control. Right? Like the way we were looked up, that admittedly, right around that hotel, that used to be the old, Intercontinental of Tehran, right? Where all those young guards, all that nonsense, is out. It's clean, which is reasonable, the food is reasonable. There is no luxury. They have removed all that nonsense. So I said that these are things now. What you see, we might talk of the problems that we have about the interpretation of Islam and whatever. But I say what is undeniable is what we can, like in terms of the daily lives of people, that is undeniable. Okay. What is also undeniable that there are millions and millions of people behind them, solid support. Right? That is undeniable. What is also undeniable, but the concept that a masjid must be the heart of a community, right? Mashaq, it's in the experience, right? I mean, demonstrated that. that it is first of all in the heart of the community. Your learned people are there. The great issues of society is really discussed there. Right? So the masjid really becomes the spiritual heart of the community. It is not a place, you know, where you go and form in the masses and then listen, nobody. It, you know, it becomes a very dynamic part of the whole society. And the great universities are built around those things. And so those things are, they say, undeniable. Right? And, but they must, something must have happened to those people. I mean, the inspiration that you see in the architecture, in the way of life, the way they jump, the poetry and all that stuff. It is like a new resurgence. I mean, to me it was incredible, ordinary men and women, in their hundreds, flowing through that, you know, the book fair and all that. You know, in a Muslim country to see those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, the other thing now, you see what you say, Muhammad, is, we have to know, look, you've got to speak from my friend. I don't want to have any pretensions of deep knowledge, right? Even in these matters. But as I, you know what I'm saying, there are certain things, right? I mean,
I think we should come back to
that. It's quite impressive.
What their beliefs is Shia, how do they differ from the Sunni Muslims' beliefs? Let's take the Sahabas. Do they accept the Sahabas as Sahabas, all of them? They accept them all. I think these are fundamental.
That's a political thing now. You see, up to the time of our Hazrat, they all accepted. You know, we must admit that there was a political conflict which took place. And then, you know, it was, you know, succession. And so the conflict arose. No, now, that doesn't take away your iman.
You know, because the ulama has to decide now whether accepting the khalifs from Hazrat Abu Bakr Siddiq and not accepting them, does it affect your iman or doesn't it? Doesn't it affect your iman? I suppose only the alims can talk on that.
But you see, I think we're getting away from the thing. We as individuals who have been involved in a society here, have come there to see a new society. Whether, you know, it's Islamic or not, it's a society which has got a lot of merit, a lot of goodness, a lot of feeling, a lot of things which no Islamic society, I mean, there's no country, including Saudi Arabia. I mean, those fellows, now this is interesting that, you know, when the students took over the American embassy, you know, in the heart of the
country,
what happened was that the university students took over. What those fellows did was they shredded documents into 1/16 of an inch. And, you know, of course they were captured. These students have restructured, you know, constructed those things. It takes 40 hours for a page. They've got 49 volumes. And that shows the whole conspiracy with which, you know, America was using. They call it the den, where the whole of the Middle East is being manipulated by the Americans, the, you know, Saudi Arabians, and, you know, wherever you know, everywhere, you know, it's the American hand. Of course, you are familiar with the fact that, you know, the fellow who now claims to be the, you know, what's his name, the Saudi king, now, the guardian of the Haram Sharia, you know,
Faisal,
you know, his history, you know, debauchery and everything, I mean, you know, now these fellows, you know, there's not one Muslim country where Islamic, you know, even according to the Sunni concept, is being practiced. You know, and here you find a society which there's some respect. And this has taken place in a matter of 7 years. You know, Kasim says that, I mean, you know, when you fly over Tehran, there's something different. You know, it's not like the ordinary cities, you know, where you have street lights going. You know, it's like a jewel, you know, the lights. And then there was an explanation for it. They don't have street lights. You know, they only have a house that conserves energy. Because, you know, the Iraqis have destroyed some of their generators. You know, now that's Tehran. You know, that they have blackouts. We won't, fortunately, you know, we didn't experience that. But, you know, the people admit that there are blackouts. You know, the fellow who's a dissenter, you know, who did not approve of it, you know, our guide's brother who's a, you know, who's well versed in English, literature and that, admitted that, you know, this was a society which is far less repressive than Savak. So there has been a transformation for the better. You see, now, you see, the other thing which impresses me is the fact that the ulema there, you know, I said there are 150,000 and 150,000 studies, and you see at those madrasas. Now, you see, if I go to Darul Uloom in this, I'm upset. How many kitabs have they got? 1,000? Yeah. Now these are little nursery schools. Those are real universities. You know the ulema there.
I mean, this
university was also started only 2 years ago.
2 years. But
what I'm saying is their knowledge, you know, very in discussion with the mullahs. You see, they have done
philosophy,
political science,
very big way.
Yeah, you know that the ulema is
formidable.
You see, our ulemas here, who come from Devon, unfortunately it's because of the syllabus, but their syllabus is so extensive. I mean, the rector of the university at is a political scientist. You know, the fellow at the Avin prison, he's a criminologist. You see that, therefore, when the revolution took place, there was a place for these mullahs in that society. Now, can we say that of our ulema?
No, but you see, you see,
now, they are certain good
aspects. Iran is a country that is hundreds of years old. These people, alright, even under the time of the Shah, the people were taking their normal education. They were being educated.
Like
alright, not like
this. Let me give you something.
Not like this. But look, these people, these professional people, did not become professional people
in their time.
What I'm trying to say is, if you take the Mughal Empire, from the Mughal Empire, this all comes from Iran. What I mean to say is, that has been a bastion of education, of knowledge, for hundreds of years, thousands of years it has been.
Yeah, but
and those people had been learning. Yet in South Africa, we've only.
But you know, Muslims, a scholarship, during certain periods has been on the
yeah,
systematic manner. You see, like, look, the Iranians, for example, but there is an aspect of life, right? You will see that now they have scholars who are now dealing essentially, right, with the Islamic sociology. There are people who will deal essentially with Islamic jurisprudence. There are people who will deal essentially with Islamic systems of government. Now the systematic, you know, the scientific method and all that. Western civilization in the earlier period, the whole scientific method and all that, it is common knowledge. Right?
No,
but Muslims now. For the first time, we see all the tremendous excitement.
All I object is an unfair comparison.
You don't have to label that one.
Against the North African.
No, I'm just saying that I'm quite impressed. They're
little babies.
You know, you can't consider them such schools. I mean, you know, one could argue and discuss. You know, they were not. I mean, and they were easily accessible.
Yeah, good.
You see, I mean.
The theory that we use is not right, is incomplete. Right? I mean, those kind of things, right, are serious factors. Right. That's a ritual.
It's
a those are very serious facts.
And that will be shown to you in their own book.
Now, where you believe they, you know, they depart in a very important way.
You know, just
from
that simple thing.
Islamic essential things.
Just that simple thing, Kasim. You can be doing all these other things.
Yeah.
MashaAllah, it's beautiful, it's very beautiful. Good. But if you do not believe that the Quran is complete, then
absolutely
any person that believes that can be
that is why the Quran Sharif that we have brought, I really would like to genuinely and quite sincerely would want to see.
Were you in the Kuwait Masjid when this professor from India came there about 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah.
And he showed us.
No.
Muhammad. He had a Quran Sharif in the masjid that he brought, Mulana Kaka saw it himself. There was one, two ayat that he showed us. In the masjid, he showed anybody that here want to come and check the Quran. This is the Quran that Iranians
read. He showed
me one ayat.
Is
it a step
of the
here? Would
he show
us here? Let me just explain
what I heard there in the masjid. Yeah. That this is the ayat of the Quran. This is what they have changed in their Quran. This is the Quran Sharif. They have changed that ayat of the Quran.
That is what I want to say.
We did that time.
No. You see, Muhammad, what you are saying is like the discussion we had earlier. Now, what I want to know is
the Quran.
We talk about what somebody must have said.
I think let us show Yusuf Bhai and Kasim.
Yes, we brought their own Quran.
I want to see.
I think now, Alhamdulillah, we've heard quite a bit from your experience, you know, in your visit to Iran. I think you can ask Mujtaba to, you know, outline to us the basic differences as far as Shiism and Sunniism, or you know, called Islamic concern. And thereafter, if you want him to substantiate whatever you think, I'm sure we can, finish to ask him questions for that. The investment of people going around in circles.
Yeah.
We'll need 12 o'clock also, and nothing will come up. Especially with my brother around here, you know.
Yeah, I think we can have tea. One question. Did you see a Sunni masjid in Tehran?
You know, 7% of the people are Sunnis. The only reason we went to masjid is, you know, when we, you know, we landed in a place and we made namaz, like, you know, I mean, we didn't specifically go to mosque, except on one day we went to the, you know, they took testament to a church. We went to a church.
Tolerating, and you know, other religions.
Yes. Yeah. And I went to a you know, a Shia mosque. Actually, it was in the mosque. It was in the hallway. We had supper at the mosque. In the Shia mosque.
When you're talking about the Shia masjid, can I just say a few words, sir? Muhammad Raja, that I discussed with you before, while he was in Iran, because there was no Sunni masjid, he and a few friends worked together, and they approached the Saudi embassy. This time there was a Saudi embassy in there. And they approached them, and they had to go there a few times to get them to agree that, or else they were financial. Is the embassy still there?
So
they got them to agree that they will finance the building of the Sunni masjid in Tehran. Now, it's not like South Africa that you just buy a ground and you put it up. So they had to start. They went to the government officials, and after going to various government officials for quite a long time, eventually, after making numerous trips, they eventually met one person that said, all right, we'll allow the Saudis to build a Sunni masjid here, but on one condition. You must allow us in return to build our masjid in Makkah. Now, this you can verify with Muhammad Raja personally.
Sorry, but what is more important? That is here, where
else? No, what I mean, I just want to put this down, that the Haram Sharif in Makkah is not sufficient for the Iranians. They want to put up their own masjid in Makkah.
That is.
They are concentrated mainly in Kurdistan, in Baluchistan province, and Kashmir. And they are on the Islamic Council, such a percentage. It's 7.8%. So they, I don't know whether we didn't go to that portion.
Well, we didn't go there. This moment, like you say, this Dr. Adesh. Now, we were actually told by them that, look, you know, they believe that the differences between the Shiites and the Sunnis in the final analysis is so slight that they are prepared. They said they have invited Sunni, you know, a scholar's room. Let's talk. You show us where we are going. We'll show you where we can spend. Let us spend something out. Now, they say they see the Sufis as Muslims.
They say, sir?
Yeah. I mean, here they told us.
But if you will be showing them documents from their own books, contrary to what they told you.
Yeah, but you must also realize this is what I was trying to point out, that you know there are 22 fit. No? And you know, you find this here too. I mean, this is what I'm telling you, that Barelvis and the Deobandis. Now, I mean, you can't say what you know, we wouldn't accept, you know, we can't, and this Barelvis can't claim to be, the figurehead or, you know, speak for the Sunnis. So I'm sure there might be sects. You know, they have mad sects. I mean, there are people, you know, there are fellows who've written kitabs who are in mental asylum.
The sect of which Imam Khomeini is in this sect does not claim you, any Zub and me, as Muslims.
But then,
the people who now you see now
this is a fact. I mean, this is going to be shown.
Well, inshallah,
let's see.
It's two things. One is aqid, one is amal, one is belief, one is action. So far, everything you have discussed was amal, action. This is happening. This is happening. This is happening. See, amal, action is external. It's external to everybody. He said, woman in Parda, you can see, I can see, you can see the whole world. There is a photograph it or not. There was a prostitution death there, it was removed, and we can all see that. And if there is going to be a gathering in the Azad Baki, or Azad the Medan, and 2-3 million gathered there, everyone can see. But Akaid is belief. Belief is internal. And what we want to show you now is after that,